we're going to go and give it our best shot to make a dent in the environment. And I think that to do that, you need to fundamentally rethink the way that things have been done before. And if you're not, you will have improvements for sure. You can optimize a system. But if the system's what got you there in the first place, you know, you've got some big questions to ask about how you're really going to do it.
Welcome back to another episode of Who's Saving the Planet. I'm Lex Heatbobber, your host. We have spent the last few months building a phenomenal roster of guests for our 2023 season, but there's a few episodes that I wanted to share with you just as a little holiday present before we get out of 2022. And this one I think is so pertinent. Back in May of this year, I had the chance to sit down with the president of the electric vehicle company Arrival. Now, this may not be one of the ones that you've heard of, but they made a huge splash in the beginning of 2021 when they went public through a SPAC, a special purpose acquisition company, that listed them at around a $13 billion valuation. And this was on the heels of them announcing a partnership with Uber, where they were going to build electric vehicles for Uber. And then later, right before we talked, they announced that UPS had put in a 10,000 delivery van order with Arrival. Now, that was in May. And at that point, their stock, which had been trading in the high teens, was down around $3 or $4. Now, since then, the stock has dipped and it's trading at about 50 cents. And it's in danger of being delisted. I bring this up because in our conversation that I had back in May with Avinash, he was very candid about the challenges that EVs face, but the necessity to continue pushing forward through times of uncertainty. Even though the market was becoming more competitive, he believes and believed that there's a bright future for the EV market and that Arrival is positioned long-term to become one of the biggest winners in the space. Here's what he had to say.
All right, let's kick this off then. Welcome back to another episode of Who's Saving the Planet. We have with us the president of Arrival, Avinash. Welcome aboard.
Thanks, Lex, and thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And we had a chance to talk before, and I'm excited about where this conversation is going because we have a lot to touch on. But I want to start at the top. Arrival is an electric vehicle company, but it is not your average bear when it comes to an electric vehicle company. Can you tell us a little bit about what you guys are doing and how you are doing it differently than some of the other names we see in this space?
Yeah, so right from the start, we've wanted to power a transition to a greener, more equitable transportation ecosystem, really based around making our cities better places to live. And to do that, we know that we need sustainable and equitable mobility ecosystems, and we need to create clean air for communities all around the world. To do that, though, we don't believe that if you simply follow what's been done to date, you can achieve a different outcome. You might improve it slightly, but you know, essentially, you're following a lot of the issues and legacies that got you to where you are in the first place, particularly in the transportation segment. So to radically change the way the industry operates, we're essentially a technology first company. So we develop a lot of key technologies in-house, and we've pioneered a new method to produce electric vehicles through microfactories, which are low capex, low footprint production facilities that can be placed locally anywhere around the world and serve the cities that need them. And these small microfactories produce our electric vehicles. But to do that, we've actually had to redesign the way an electric vehicle is engineered as well. So you can't just take an existing vehicle and produce it in a microfactory. You actually have to fundamentally think about the production facility and the vehicle as one system. So we've had to develop a bunch of key technologies through vertical integration. So we've invented in-house, you know, the hardware. So all the components that go into the vehicle, the battery management system, compute boards, all of those are done in-house and they're shared across all the vehicle types. We've had to go develop the software. So lower level control on each of those components. We can basically control and tell exactly what's going on every one of those components and get all the data off. And I'm sure we'll touch on that a little bit as well. And then we've got the robotics. So within the microfactory, we use off-the-shelf robotics, but all of the control is actually Arrival. So how the actual microfactory operates is all in-house tech. And that includes us creating brand new autonomous mobile robots to bring parts around the microfactory. Some really cool videos on YouTube on that. And finally, we've had to develop a totally new material to replace steel for our body panels. So steel typically needs a large metal stamping plant and a paint shop, which isn't very good for the environment at all. And instead of that, we've created a composite material that is fully recyclable and doesn't need paint. The fabric itself, it starts as a fabric, and using our molding processes, we're able to turn it into panels that are lighter, more durable than steel, but don't need a paint shop. We do all of this because we believe that's how you get the price point of the vehicle down, you produce them locally, and you can start to create vehicles at a very different economic model to what's been done before. So it really is a disruptor and enables better mobility solutions for people everywhere, you know, improving access to goods, healthcare, school, et cetera.
So you guys are also, you're starting with light heavyweight vehicles, or what is it specifically called? I don't think it's light heavyweight. It's not quite that, or oxymoronic.
We call it commercial vehicles.
So your vans, your lorries.
Yeah.
And then also buses. So you're moving into a public transportation sector, and then eventually going to be moving into the more commercial cars that are going to be more consumer driven. But I want to take a minute and pause on one aspect of that you said that I don't fully understand, which is the software part. Now, you on your last quarterly call, which I read because I'm trying to do my homework over here, said Arrival's unique quality is that we're vertically integrated. This means we design and build not just our vehicles, but all of our core systems, software, and sensors within them. All of Arrival systems are designed in such a way that they share structured data about health, performance, and efficiency. It's also possible to send in raw data about any signal or perimeter, which is available in any system. The significant data we generate and how this is expected to act as a multiplier for per vehicle revenue for Arrival. So from what I gather from that, you're saying that this software is going to make the value of the cars increase. What does that mean, and how are you doing that, and how is that different from what's going on in some of the other electric companies out there?
Yeah, so this is an extremely important point that I think we sometimes gets overlooked when you think about commercial vehicles. So I think, you know, upfront commercial vehicles contribute about 30% of the global CO2 emissions within the transportation sector. So when you think about its impact on the environment, it's critically important that we really look at these commercial vehicles. And in the US, it's actually about 82% of the greenhouse gases are from light, medium, and heavy duty vehicles, but it's only 5% of the vehicles on the road. So there is a very specific reason from the environment to go after that. But on a flip side, when you think about these heavy use vehicles, miles every day driven, what we have created is the components that are sitting in the van, the bus, and the car that we're designing, for example, with Uber, they share those components. So that's the battery, how the battery's operating, the drivetrain, the motors, the human machine interface, like down to what buttons people are pressing and how they're interacting with the vehicle, how hard they are on the throttle and on the brakes, all of that information we gather across all the vehicles. Now, when you're collecting all of that data, you get to do sort of two things with it. One is look at how the vehicle is operating and determine if there are actual product improvements that you want to do based on that data. Right. So you can literally say, hey, if you look at this sort of usage curve of how people use the throttle, we can tune the vehicle in a very specific way. Right. That's a very basic example of the type of information we get back.
And I bet those vehicles get like really hard use, right? Like, I mean, those are being driven where people have quotas about how quickly they need to do things like drop off packages. And so you hear these stories of people just like beating the hell out of these vehicles, and any kind of efficiency you can squeeze out of that, I imagine, has like pretty big systemic effects.
Exactly. And we've actually seen the vehicles at end of life. And like you said, I mean, they are beaten up, right?
They gotta be. It's also not yours, right? If you stop me into it, like as somebody who's on a job, I mean, when I, back in the far begotten days when I had a job and I was working for somebody else, like there's a different way that you treat the things that are the function of your job than they are your personal assets.
It's just, I heard a great quote once, which was the fastest car is a rental car. Yeah, exactly. The fastest car in the world, right? So you're right, and so that insight lets you tune the vehicle, but it also means that you can bring all of those through APIs, which is essentially a layer that allows anybody access information. And so you can imagine whether it's a UPS or it's a small, medium enterprise, we can provide the pipe into the vehicle so that you can see it. You as a fleet owner can see how that small fleet is or large fleet is being used, where you're seeing the major issues, how you plan your routes based on the range requirements that you actually get versus what you state that you get, you know, because of your driving patterns. You can literally get all of that information, and we build the fleet tools on top of that to help you. So it can help you predict how many vehicles you actually need, how you should run them, how you schedule your jobs. And that's all because we have access to a really mega data set of vehicles across the fleet. And so when you think about commercial vehicles, it's not just the upfront purchase price, it's the total cost of ownership. And that helps to reduce the total cost of ownership on a day-by-day, hour-by-hour basis. And obviously that provides a opportunity for a rival on the revenue side, which is, you know, all on the software tools, and it becomes a recurring revenue opportunity rather than typically a vehicle is you sort of buy it and then you sort of forget
about it. There you go. I mean, if you were to say like, traditionally, I would not only sell you the car, but I own the maintenance shop.
Yeah.
But you're saying like, I can sell you the vehicle, but also continue to make improvements on it and charge a subscription service like a SaaS exactly. model to give, then that can raise the overall value of the vehicle for you guys while also creating a better experience for your.
It's win-win. They reduce their operational costs and we, you know, generate recurring revenue, but we can go even further. We've talked about just the software, but the hardware, the components, mm-hmm. they're designed to be upgradable as well. So we use a plug and play architecture similar to what you would find in a desktop computer, but you wouldn't necessarily, would never find it in a vehicle, which is each of our components, we can take one out and plug in a new one and the system reconfigures with that new component. So you can imagine like after 8 years, 10 years, 20 years, let's just take Bluetooth. I don't know how long Bluetooth's been around for. I'm not sure it was around 20 years ago, right? But even the Bluetooth standards have changed, 5G standards. And now, you know, now we've got BLE, we've got 5G. What does that mean in 8 to 10 years? You know, you want to be able to upgrade the asset on a hardware perspective as well, because the commercial vehicles are used over a long period of time and they're used every day and often.
You're seeing that trend in sustainability writ large, this idea of like planned obsolescence is the least efficient way to use things. And we need to have parts that can be interchangeable and replaceable so that you're not like refurbishing the entire thing, whether it's furniture, whether it's clothing, exactly. whether it's technology, whether it's vehicles, it's the same principle.
Exactly.
Like repair, not replace, just because we're running out of time here. But you mentioned like looking forward. You, before you were the president of Arrival, were at Cruise, the GM self-driving car company. And so I got to wonder, the future here in some way or another is going to involve some degree of automation. You seem to be the perfect, like the intersection of these two things. You have come from a place that was focused on that, and now you are looking at service vehicles that largely follow systematic routes. They're things that ideally don't need that much variation from day to day to day. That would be the perfect use case for an automated system. Where do you see that going? How do you see your prior experiences informing the direction of your current company?
Yeah, so obviously, you know, being part of Cruise, I was at the inflection point of that industry. You know, I was at GM and then I led that acquisition across. And when I joined Cruise, we were just really starting this sort of transitionary phase in autonomous. Autonomous has been around for a long time, but that was sort of an inflection point where we had the large OEMs start to really take an investment in that space and really drive it forward. What we've seen from there is obviously it's very difficult. Similar to what we're doing at Arrival, and you'll have your ups and downs because you're creating something totally new. Now, autonomy, if you look at it on a global standpoint, there's still a long way to go. I do believe that we will drive electrification or zero emission vehicles faster than we'll drive autonomy globally. But they go hand in hand, to your point. They do operate hand in hand. And one of the reasons is just the sensor suite, right? It just makes more sense to run it on an electric vehicle with all the compute rather than a nice vehicle. And I think everybody's already sort of made that choice. Autonomy in the commercial vehicle segment is a really interesting intersection point because there's already parts of the operation that you can make autonomous. So if you think about the depot, I don't know if you've been to a bus depot. It is amazing just how buses park. Like
the Port Authority of New York is one of my favorite places. My wife and I, we visit that regularly. So yes, a bus depot, of course.
So just even organizing keys, right? Like, and just moving buses in and out to be able to park them. You know, we've been to van depots where their vehicles are parked so close next to each other that, you know, you scratch the vehicles, and those sorts of things within the depot, existing technology today can automate them. So moving from the cleaning station to the loading station, the parking, all of that, the tech exists today. It's not full self-driving on the road, but that technology right now, we can do that. And in fact, Arrival's actually already demonstrated that with our autonomous depot project. Going forward, we see a lot of advancement in the commercial vehicle segment being able to adopt ADAS type technologies ahead of the passenger segment. So for example, you know, the driver aids, things like being able to go deliver a package and keep the vehicle moving around the block while you do so, for example, rather than engaging in like parking tickets, which costs operators a ton of money just because they get parking tickets when they park their vehicles to do deliveries. And if you think about the one key thing about the commercial vehicle segment is majority of those use cases still need a human involved in the operation. You know, you still need to bring the package, for example, from the vehicle to the doorstep. For example, that's in a van. In a bus, there's a safety aspect there when you have a driver as well. So it's about
how... And a human aspect, I would imagine, like just walking into a bus and not seeing a bus driver, that's a learning curve, right? From a person to be like, I'm not sure I feel or what I feel about that.
Exactly. So if you can add those technologies to make the driver or human in the loop job more efficient, then you are adding to the sort of operational efficiency of that product, right? So, you know, if you imagine the van doesn't get into any accidents, can do the prior braking, can make sure, you know, no cyclists get, you know, accidentally hit when a van's pulling out, all those sorts of things. If you add those technologies in, you're essentially making that vehicle more safe for its occupants and the people outside. So you can already see that autonomy will have a place to play. As you go globally, though, you find that, you know, there's certain cities that it's just going to take a really long time because of the traffic density, the different types of vehicles. The algorithms won't cope with that for quite a while, nor will the sensor suite necessarily. We're seeing improvements, but they don't apply to every weather condition, for example, everywhere. And it is a very rule-based type process, right, in terms of autonomy. You follow the road rules, et cetera. And you and I both know there's some places where that is certainly not the case. You do what you need to do to get from A to B.
So if you're in Amsterdam versus if you're in Bangkok, like you're going to have a very different relationship with traffic.
So when you think about the problem you're trying to solve, you've got to solve these problems locally. And that sort of comes back to the philosophy of Arrival and the microfactory, right? We're trying to work with cities to create the local solution. It still blows my mind that no matter where you travel around the world, you essentially have the same vehicle types. And it doesn't make sense because cities are so different. Mm-hmm. And so having a local production facility with a transportation product, you know, a vehicle built for that city, but it's incorporated into whether that's public transportation, you know, that's sustainable mobility for those who are less abled, you know, and autonomy plays a huge role there, absolutely massive role of bringing parts of society that have been sort of left out back into the ability for them to, you know, get to social events, get to work, hospital, whatever that is, that many of us enjoy almost as a given. So all these technologies play a role, but what's most important is looking at the problem you're trying to solve in the area you are and for what purpose, you know, what is the actual outcome you're looking to drive, and then create the solutions together. So you've got autonomy, electrification, you know, we know about connected vehicles, shared mobility solutions, public transportation. You know, these all have to come together to move people and goods.
So you have two massive LOIs, letters of intent out there. Mm-hmm. One's with UPS, and that's the 10,000 vehicles and this sort of like you said, the delivery service thing. And the other was with Uber. And I know there's also a lot of bus programs that you have in UK that you're developing now. But thinking about it, the Uber perspective from a minute, because that is traditionally we're pushing this idea of autonomy pretty hard. And there's this moral hazard part about this, which is like where it is very true that the least efficient part of Uber is the driver. However, what does that world look like? You know, there's, we can't push forward technology without some kind of consequences. And there's lots of very good ones, but there's also some that we won't necessarily know until we get to that point. And you've spent the last 10 years, 15 years, like thinking about this frontier of transportation. Where do you see those potential consequences coming back to us? And how can we be conscious of them, if not mitigate them, as we are continuing this forward push of technology? Because that certainly is not going to slow down.
Yeah. So just a quick correction. We don't have a LOI with Uber. What we've announced is a publicly announced a development project with them. Just wanted
Thank
to
you. Make no, sure that's so. That's important. The lawyer important. Somewhere in the back of your mind was like, listen.
We do have a lot of LOIs, though. So over 150,000. So I think the where I see it going, like I said, I do see it. It's going to be regional and even down to local. Mm-hmm. But the point you're making addresses a transition in the auto industry that has actually never actually occurred before, right? So if you think about the industry at large, what has happened was, you know, since Henry Ford, we've sort of put vehicles together in a very specific way. It's had a lot of humans. We added robots to it, but humans still formed a major part of the line. And then the vehicle themselves have always needed an operator. And what we're seeing now going forward is that some parts of the transportation segment are going to potentially move away from needing the operator, mm-hmm. whether that's ride sharing taxis, which is where you're seeing the majority of the movement, right? Whether it's Cruise or Waymo or others, that's where a lot of the focus is actually right now. I think we're going to see a situation where, you know, TV didn't kill the radio. There's going to be adjustments here where there's going to be mixed use for quite a significant amount of time, you know, decades. But what you're touching on is something that's very important, which is where's the equality in the system? And that, I think, is important to look at the transportation segment outside of simply the vehicle, but rather across economic segments, right? So I'll give you an example. In the event that you have vehicle accidents don't stop and start in the transportation segment. Improving vehicle safety improves the expected health of a city, right? It goes all the way through to what's happening within the hospitals and so on and so forth, right? And the duty of care that you have to provide post-accident, you know? So there is a lot within just something that you might just call an accident, a car accident, that is affects the economy at large and society at large, right? And of course, if an accident is bad enough, there's a lot of human emotional side to that as well. Autonomy starts to address some of those things. And what we've got to do is figure out the framework for how do we balance out the different economic impacts of something like autonomy. So, you know, in the event that one sector going to lose jobs, and does that translate into economic growth somewhere else? And where could that be so that we can think about ahead of time, what do we want to be putting in place? Whether that's the educational system transforming or really understanding where we see the shift of movement of jobs, for example. Really simple one is that we know that autonomous vehicles will affect the real estate market because where you live and work changes. Now, great example of that is COVID. It's actually already started to shift that, right? And so we need to really be thinking about this. I don't have the silver bullet here, Lex, but what I do know is it needs to be thought of as an accounting or economic model that is very holistic. Because as you're starting to introduce autonomy or electrification into the vehicle, we often talk about, okay, we're going to subsidize electric vehicles, right? Electric vehicles have a benefit to the economy that's beyond just the operating costs we've talked before. It's also the environmental cost. Right. And do we understand, you know, can we actually create an economic model that says, okay, if we reduce the greenhouse gas by X amount per city, that has this net benefit to the overall economy of that city that can then be reinvested into education or new jobs, et cetera, in new sectors. And that to me is the most unique thing about the transportation revolution right now, is it's not just we're not just talking about transportation anymore. We're talking about an industry that's had 100 odd years where it's basically stayed the same. And now we're at a point where it's all turning on its head. Whether it's the powertrain, whether it's autonomy, whether it's shared mobility, whatever is coming this way is a complete transportation disruptor. And so to say that autonomy will have X impact on a segment is missing the overall picture here. And that's what we've got to actually be focusing on. When, and we work very closely with cities to look at that. So for example, we're working with the city of Charlotte to understand what does putting a microfactory mean for the city's GDP? How many jobs does it create? How many additional jobs does it create based on those jobs? And so on, you know, and so forth.
Yeah, your secondary and your tertiary effects.
And that needs to happen for autonomy. And that's kind of the missing piece in the conversation right now, because I think the most obvious thing is, okay, if we remove a driver, for example, we've lost a job. But that's not necessarily the case. But we have to deeply understand, where does it actually move to?
And it can just be scary. You know, I think just in general, the idea, not just even about driving a car, but this idea of rapid change that we're having to deal with across so many things. Getting into a car, like you said, is something that's been so stable for the, you know, many a generation. And the idea of that changing very quickly can be hard to sort of understand. Like you said, what are the second, tertiary, order effects, and how does that going to ripple through life?
And it's going to be different legs for different places. You know, it's interesting. I moved from California to London, and I don't have a car here. I don't own a car in London. I catch public transport and use, you know, Uber and shared mobility systems. Obviously, London transportation system is quite incredible compared to what I've been used to in other places. And I'm a car guy through and through. And you know, at least in London, I don't miss it. So it's going to depend as well on sort of where you live and, you know, what you have access to. It's not a straightforward transition.
I grew up in Southern California. And so I fully know when you have the windows down and you're singing out and it's the middle of the night and no one's there. Particular bliss to that moment.
Yeah, I agree.
So along with this is that the public markets themselves recognize this transition is happening very quickly. And we've seen this explosion of electric vehicle companies coming to the public markets in the last 24 months. Mm-hmm. And there was this like really, really frothy environment for them coming on board. And that has since like cooled quite a bit across all of the EV chains and also electric battery companies, recycling companies. There's sort of this like things are happening so quickly that billions of dollars in market value are generated and then lost in what is a vanishingly short period of time. Arrival amongst them, but certainly not the only one. It sort of is just like in general, the industry is expanding and contracting at paces that we haven't seen before. How do you navigate those short-term swings without losing vision of the long-term, where you guys see this going? And like, to what effect does that have on the actual business of running a company?
That's a really, really good question. So obviously we are aware of it. Like you said, you know, we even Arrival, obviously, since going public, it's been quite volatile. You know, I don't think I'm necessarily saying anything new there. It's been volatile. I mean, everyone can go have a look at it. And then, you know, we do read the Reddits. We do talk to our investors. We are fully aware. There's limited things that we're actually able to say on a stock price based on the rules that are in place, right? So just to make that clear.
Right. But what even we less about the stock on, price, though, just in general, the like
general market volatility where the investments have gone and now are shifting across. We're seeing that the market is moving to more sort of safe bets, which is normal, right? As you start to see sort of the economic change. In terms of the company, from that sense, it's very straightforward. You know, the company is simply a collection of people. That's all a company is. Hmm. It's a collection of people. That collection of people at Arrival have created incredible IP, incredible. As COVID is sort of ending, we're getting more and more people into the microfactories and coming to visit us to show just how much we have created. I think you always got to stick with the fundamentals. You've just got to put it aside. We know what our vision is. We know where we're heading. And then it becomes, what is important for us to achieve today, this week, this month, this year? And the culture will drive the focus that you need to get it done. And that's important because it's not going to be easy. Anytime you do something transformative like we are, it's going to be like a bumpy road. But the culture is what's going to get you through. Second, I would say that there are a lot of companies that are doing this. And it's difficult for everybody to pass out, okay, why is Arrival or X company any different? You know, so I'd like to make it very simple for everybody listening. You know, Arrival's vertical integration is a key differentiator. Arrival, we're going to start production basically later this year. out of a microfactory. I just want to stop and just double click on that. What does that mean? It means that a vehicle, for the first time, I believe, in history, as far as I'm aware, is going to be produced in a warehouse that you could find in any city, using a combination of off-the-shelf robotics with internally designed robotics and technologies, taking fabric, composite material fabrics, and turning them into panels with vertical integration, plug and play components that all plug into the floor, you know, fully flat floor. All of that's going to come together and create an electric van rolling out of it for the first time. That is a fundamental step change in industry. Going from these large mega gigafactories out in the middle of nowhere, really heavy, whether it's energy requirements, whether it's water usage, whether it's the environmental effects of paint shops and so on and so forth, to this agile production system, which, by the way, at some point could go beyond vehicles, right? That's where we're starting now. And that, to me, that is so close to us and so important over the next decades that that's what we focus on. And then always grounding yourself on what's the positive impact you're trying to do. I think that's what gets you through kind of, I won't say ignoring, you acknowledge it and you acknowledge what's going on, but you focus on what you need to do and just do that day by day. And that's culture.
That's culture, 100%, right? That's, like you said, a company is a collection of people. And if those people all believe some shared vision, that can get you through the volatility of the external world, trying to apply their sense of basically making bets, right? Like,
exactly.
The stock market's a strange place. To your point though, the microfactory, from what your literature has will have the capacity to create 10,000 cars a year and will only cost 38 million pounds to build. And that will reduce the amount of time that you need to forecast different trends in terms of where cars and vans and buses will be needed. And that allows for much more agility, like you said, than making a massive CapEx expense that will, you know, need to amortize over the course of decades in order for it to make sense. So that is like really a fundamental change. It's going to be very interesting to see how that can shift the mindsets of some of the other competitors that have spent generations doing it the same way.
I think
it gives you a leverage with local communities to say, here, we can create a positive impact, and you can see the factory, you can see the jobs, especially if you're thinking about this public-private partnership for the use case of your vehicles. That's a very useful thing to have. I'm interviewing the head of UPS's sustainability later this week, and part of the things I want to know is, like, how do you marry the $27 million in public donations that you've made to politicians over the last decade and the idea that you're going to be sustainable? Like, it's hard to do that, you know, like, but that's neither here nor there.
Well, you know what, Lex, on that point, I mean, I can't speak for any particular company. I'm going to express my own opinion. We don't have a choice. We're at 400 plus parts per million, right? In terms of
100%
the environment, we don't have a choice. I mean, we can debate it in which way we want to do it. And there is obviously, those are fair discussion points, but as an overall objective, we're past that point, you know, and that's why Arrival exists. We're going to go and give it our best shot to make a dent in the environment. And I think from a positive aspect, of course. And I think that to do that, you need to fundamentally rethink the way that things have been done before. And if you're not, you will have improvements for sure. You can optimize a system. But if the system's what got you there in the first place, you know, you've got some big questions to ask about how you're really going to do it. And I think for Arrival, blank sheet approach allowed us to go off and sort of rethink this from, we call it good for people, business, and the planet, right? So if we can sort of cross those three things, is it good for society? Is it good for business? And is it good for the environment? Then yes, that's a tick for a project that we want to take on.
Yeah.
And what the importance of a microfactory goes beyond the efficiency of it. But what we want to see is, you know, hundreds of microfactories all around the world. You know, so if you go to Cape Town, you're in Bangkok, you're in, you know, Washington, it has a microfactory. Local staff are producing the vehicles that are being used locally. And to your point, we can start to then, it's all software defined, right? So you can start to shift what microfactory is building what vehicle based on what's needed within that local region. That is something, again, you know, right now, we're talking about a replacement model. We're replacing the buses with an electric bus, replacing the van with an electric van, better ones.
Right.
The production system, you know, large capex, huge factories with small factories. But what that doesn't show is what are the business innovations that come post that. We touched on software, but really at the flick of a switch, you can change what microfactory is building what vehicle.
Hmm.
And when you start to think of a production line, that's impossible. You just cannot do it that flexible.
By
that
definition, agile. It's designed to not do that.
Exactly. So we're at the start of something totally new that took 100 odd years to optimize to today's. We're at the start of that journey with a microfactory, and that's what's so exciting for us. It doesn't have to be just a rival, of course. I mean, these technologies are platforms, but you do need to fundamentally redesign a vehicle. You just cannot take an existing vehicle and expect to build in a microfactory. It's never going to work.
Yeah. So I want to close out with a question that I ask a lot of people, but I'm going to change it a little bit. Usually I say, what advice would you give yourself when you were starting out this project? But your career has taken many different paces. So instead, I want to reframe it like this. We have on the call here, Rana, and she's been sitting with us for a while. And I'm going to use you, Rana, as sort of the avatar for a younger generation person. So like somebody that's at the beginning of looking at the future and saying, all I've known is fantastic uncertainty from everything. And now we have this existential climate crisis bearing down on us, not to mention any number of daily crises. It's just this like constant thing. What advice would you give to somebody in the beginning stage of their career about how to navigate that uncertainty and how you've been able to curry that to create this like increasingly depth of knowledge and experience and career through many different avenues?
Well, firstly, I'd rather take advice from Rana. So, but I think persistence. If you believe in something, resilience is probably two words that probably come to mind: resilience and passion, and they go hand to hand. Care about what you do, like care about the details. The details matter, and be resilient because it's going to be whatever you put on paper as your plan. And Rana's smiling because she knows this. Whatever we put on paper, it's all the moment you put it on paper, right? So you got to have resilience. You got to be quick to react. But the best way to be able to react to something is to understand the details. And that's the best advice I could give anyone starting, entrepreneur, or you know, even in your studies, whatever it is you're doing, sport, understand the details. Because you know, when I, for example, did the chocolate company, I went and waited the tables. You know, now I'm in London, I catch the bus, you know? So I think it's important because when you put yourself in the context of the challenge that you're passionate about, then you really understand it. Like you deeply understand it. And when you deeply understand something, your response to issues or hurdles is going to be one that is understanding the broader context of what you're trying to do, right? So you pick solutions that don't just solve the immediate problem, but still help you get around the hurdle and still to your goal. Mm-hmm. And that's the most challenging thing in a startup. And that's what lets you pivot really quickly, for example, because you know you still understand what you're trying to achieve. So resilience and passion, they go hand in hand. They feed off each other sometimes negatively, right? I think we've all had days where so many hurdles that you kind of lose your passion and vice versa, right? So, but those are the two. With that, you know, you're gonna think about everything that comes your way in a slightly different, like subconscious way.
All right, there you go. You've heard it, Rana. That's for both of us here. We need to be both as resilient and passionate as we can, because goodness.
That's for me too. I go through it every day as well, don't worry.
Rarely does the world cooperate with our best laid plans. So I think that's fantastic advice. Avinash, thank you very much for joining us today. This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your perspective, and I'm so excited to see what you guys do in the next 12 months. This is going to be a remarkable year for you.
Yes. Yeah. It's a huge one. So
all right, really, well, keep us posted. We want to be supporters of yours. When you have updates, let us know, Rana. We're gonna get it out there to the people.
Rana, when it's time, we'll get Lex to the actual microfactory. We'll give you a tour.
Live
from the microfactory.
That sounds perfect. All right, guys. Cheers.
All right. Brilliant. Thank you, Lex.
And that was our conversation with the president of Arrival, Avinash Rugabur. I'm your host, Lex Kiefhaber. Our theme music is by James Rhodes. This episode was produced by Matt Simons. And a special thanks to everyone who has helped out working on these episodes so far, not the least of which is my dog Simon, who is not here for this episode, but he'll be back in the future. All right, tune in next week or soon for another episode of Who's Saving the Planet?
Okay, that was great. Good job. That was, I think that was awesome. It was a great conversation. Felt good. I don't know. I think that was excellent.
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Perfect.